The blues are because you're getting fatter. Maybe it's been raining too long. You're sad, that's all. But the mean reds are horrible. You're afraid and you sweat like hell, but you don't know what you're afraid of. Except something bad is going to happen, only you don't know what it is. You've had that feeling?
Quite often. Some people call it angst.
All right, angst. But what do you do about it?
Well, a drink helps.
Well, I've tried that. I've tried aspirin, too. Rusty thinks I should smoke marijuana, and I did for a while, but it only makes me giggle. What I've found does the most good is just to get into a taxi and go to Tiffany's. It calms me down right away, the quietness and the proud look of it. Nothing very bad could happen to you there, not with those kind men in their nice suits and that lovely smell of silver and alligator wallets. If I could find a real-life place that made me feel like Tiffany's, then I'd buy some furniture and give the cat a name. I thought maybe after the war, Fred and I...
She pushed up her dark glasses and her eyes, the differing colors of them, the gray and wisps of blue and green, had taken on a far-seeing sharpness.
I went to Mexico once. It's a wonderful country for raising horses. I saw one place near the sea. Fred's good with horses.
Rusty Trawler came carrying a martini. He handed it over without looking at me.
I'm hungry,
he announced, and his voice, retarded as the rest of him, produced an unnerving brat whine that seemed to blame Holly.
It's 7:30 and I'm hungry. You know what the doctor said.
Yes, Rusty, I know what the doctor said.
Well, then break it up. Let's go.
I want you to behave, Rusty,
she spoke softly. But there was a governess threat of punishment in her tone that caused an odd flush of pleasure, of gratitude, to pink his face.
You don't love me, he complained, as though they were alone.
Nobody loves naughtiness.
Obviously she'd said what he wanted to hear. It appeared to both excite and relax him. Still, he continued as though it were a ritual.
Do you love me?
She patted him.
Tend to your chores, Rusty, and when I'm ready, we'll go eat wherever you want.
Chinatown?
But that doesn't mean sweet and sour spare ribs. You know what the doctor said.
As he returned to his duties with a satisfied waddle, I couldn't resist reminding her that she hadn't answered his question. Do you love him?
I told you, you can make yourself love anybody. Besides, he had a stinking childhood.
If it was so stinking, why does he cling to it?
Use your head. Can't you see it's just that Rusty feels safer in diapers than he would in a skirt? Which is really the choice, only he's awfully touchy about it. He tried to stab me with a butter knife because I told him to grow up and face the issue, settle down and play house with a nice fatherly truck driver. Meantime, I've got him on my hands, which is okay. He's harmless. He thinks girls are dolls, literally.
Thank God.
Well, if it were true of most men, I'd hardly be thanking God.
I meant thank God you're not going to marry Mr. Trawler. She lifted an eyebrow.
By the way, I'm not pretending I don't know he's rich. Even land in Mexico costs something. Now,
she said, motioning me forward,
let's get hold of O.J.
I held back while my mind worked to win a postponement. Then I remembered, why traveling?
On my card, she said, disconcerted. You think it's funny?
Not funny, just provocative. She shrugged.
After all, how do I know where I'll be living tomorrow? So I told them to put traveling. Anyway, it was a waste of money ordering those cards, except I felt I owed it to them to buy some little something. They're from Tiffany's.
She reached for my martini. I hadn't touched it. She drained it in two swallows and took my hand.
Quit stalling. You're going to make friends with O.J.
An occurrence at the door intervened. It was a young woman, and she entered like a wind rush, a squall of scarves and jangling gold.
Holly, she said, wagging a finger as she advanced. You miserable hoarder, hogging all those simply riveting men.
She was well over 6 feet, taller than most men there. They straightened their spines, sucked in their stomachs. There was a general contest to match her swaying height. Holly said, "What are you doing here?" And her lips were taut as drawn string.
"Why, nothing, sugar. I've been upstairs working with Yunioshi. Christmas stuff for the bazaar. But you sound vexed, sugar."
She scattered a roundabout smile.
"You boys not vexed at me for butting in on your party?"
Rusty Trawler tittered. He squeezed her arm as though to admire her muscle and asked her if she could use a drink.
"I surely could," she said. "Make mine bourbon."
Holly told her, "There isn't any." Whereupon the Air Force colonel suggested he run out for a bottle.
"No, I declare, don't let's have a fuss. I'm happy with ammonia. Holly, honey,"
she said, slightly shoving her,
"don't you bother about me. I can introduce myself."
She stooped toward O.J. Berman, who, like many short men in the presence of tall women, had an aspiring mist in his eye.
"I'm Mag Wildwood from Wildwood, Arkansas. That's hill country."
It seemed a dance, Berman performing some fancy footwork to prevent his rivals cutting in. He lost her to a quadrille of partners who gobbled up her stammered jokes like popcorn tossed to pigeons. It was a comprehensible success. She was a triumph over ugliness, so often more beguiling than real beauty, if only because it contains paradox. In this case, as opposed to the scrupulous method of plain good taste and scientific grooming, the trick had been worked by exaggerating defects. She'd made them ornamental by admitting them boldly. Heels that emphasized her height, so steep her ankles trembled. A flat, tight bodice that indicated she could go to a beach in bathing trunks. Hair that was pulled straight back, accentuating the spareness, the starvation of her fashion model face. Even the stutter, certainly genuine but still a bit laid on, had been turned to advantage. It was the masterstroke, that stutter, for it contrived to make her banalities sound somehow original. And secondly, despite her tallness, her assurance, it served to inspire in male listeners a protective feeling. To illustrate, Berman had to be pounded on the back because she said,
"Who can tell me where is the John?"
Then completing the cycle, he offered an arm to guide her himself.
"That," said Holly, "won't be necessary. She's been here before. She knows where it is."
She was emptying ashtrays, and after Mag Wildwood had left the room, she emptied another, then said, sighed rather,
"It's really very sad."
She paused long enough to calculate the number of inquiring expressions. It was sufficient.
"And so mysterious. You'd think it would show more, but heaven knows she looks healthy. So, well, clean. That's the extraordinary part. Wouldn't you," she asked with concern, but of no one in particular, "wouldn't you say she looked clean?"
Someone coughed. Several swallowed. A naval officer who had been holding Mag Wildwood's drink put it down.
"But then," said Holly, "I hear so many of these southern girls have the same trouble."
She shuddered delicately and went to the kitchen for more ice. Mag Wildwood couldn't understand it, the abrupt absence of warmth on her return. The conversations she began behaved like green logs. They fumed but would not fire. More unforgivably, people were leaving without taking her telephone number. The Air Force colonel decamped while her back was turned, and this was the straw too much. He'd asked her to dinner. Suddenly she was blind, and since gin to artifice bears the same relation as tears to mascara, her attractions at once dissembled. She took it out on everyone. She called her hostess a Hollywood degenerate. She invited a man in his 50s to fight. She told Berman Hitler was right. She exhilarated Rusty Trawler by stiff-arming him into a corner.
"You know what's going to happen to you?" she said with no hint of a stutter. "I'm going to march you over to the zoo and feed you to the yak."
He looked altogether willing, but she disappointed him by sliding to the floor where she sat, humming.
"You're a bore. Get up from there,"
Holly said, stretching on a pair of gloves. The remnants of the party were waiting at the door, and when the boar didn't budge, Holly cast me an apologetic glance.
"Be an angel, would you, Fred? Put her in a taxi. She lives at the Winslow." "Don't,"
Liv Barbizon, Regent 45700, ask for Mag Wildwood.
You are an angel, Fred.
They were gone. The prospect of steering an Amazon into a taxi obliterated whatever resentment I felt. But she solved the problem herself. Rising on her own steam, she stared down at me with a lurching loftiness. She said,
"Let's go stork, catch Lucky Balloon,"
and fell full length like an axed oak. My first thought was to run for a doctor, but examination proved her pulse fine and her breathing regular. She was simply asleep. After finding a pillow for her head, I left her to enjoy it. The following afternoon, I collided with Holly on the stairs.
"You,"
she said, hurrying past with a package from the druggist.
"There she is on the verge of pneumonia, a hangover out to here, and the mean reds on top of it."
I gathered from this that Mag Wildwood was still in the apartment, but she gave me no chance to explore her surprising sympathy. Over the weekend, mystery deepened. First, there was the Latin who came to my door, mistakenly, for he was inquiring after Miss Wildwood. It took a while to correct his error. Our accents seemed mutually incoherent. But by the time we had, I was charmed. He'd been put together with care. His brown head and bullfighter's figure had an exactness, a perfection, like an apple, an orange, something nature has made just right. Added to this, as decoration, were an English suit and a brisk cologne, and, what is still more un-Latin, a bashful manner. The second event of the day involved him again. It was toward evening, and I saw him on my way out to dinner. He was arriving in a taxi. The driver helped him totter into the house with a load of suitcases. That gave me something to chew on. By Sunday, my jaws were quite tired. Then the picture became both darker and clearer. Sunday was an Indian summer day. The sun was strong, my window was open, and I heard voices on the fire escape. Holly and Mag were sprawled there on a blanket, the cat between them. Their hair, newly washed, hung lankly. They were busy, Holly varnishing her toenails, Mag knitting on a sweater. Mag was speaking.
"If you ask me, I think you're lucky. At least there's one thing you can say for Rusty. He's an American."
"Bully for him."
"Sugar, there's a war on."
"And when it's over, you've seen the last of me, boy."
"I don't feel that way. I'm proud of my country. The men in my family were great soldiers. There's a statue of Papa Daddy Wildwood smack in the center of Wildwood."
"Fred's a soldier,"
said Holly.
"But I doubt if he'll ever be a statue." "Could be. They say the more stupid you are, the braver. He's pretty stupid."
"Fred's that boy upstairs? I didn't realize he was a soldier, but he does look stupid."
"Yearning, not stupid. He wants awfully to be on the inside, staring out. Anybody with their nose pressed against a glass is liable to look stupid. Anyway, he's a different Fred. Fred's my brother."
"You call your own flesh and blood stupid?"
"If he is, he is."
"Well, it's poor taste to say so. A boy that's fighting for you and me and all of us. What is this, a bond rally? I just want you to know where I stand. I appreciate a joke, but underneath I'm a serious person, proud to be an American. That's why I'm sorry about Jose."
She put down her knitting needles.
"You do think he's terribly good-looking, don't you?"
Holly said, and swiped the cat's whiskers with her lacquer brush.
"If only I could get used to the idea of marrying a Brazilian and being a Brazilian myself. It's such a canyon to cross, 6,000 miles, and not knowing the language."
"Go to Berlitz."
"Why on earth would they be teaching Portuguese? It isn't as though anyone spoke it. No, my only chance is to try and make Jose forget politics and become an American. It's such a useless thing for a man to want to be the president of Brazil." She sighed and picked up her knitting. "I must be madly in love. You saw us together. Do you think I'm madly in love?"
"Well, does he bite?"
Mag dropped a stitch.
"Bite?
You, in bed."
"Why, no, should he?"
Then she added censoriously,
but he does laugh.
Good, that's the right spirit. I like a man who sees the humor. Most of them, they're all pant and puff.
Mag withdrew her complaint. She accepted the comment as flattery, reflecting on herself.
Yes, I suppose.
Okay, he doesn't bite, he laughs. What else?
Mag counted up her dropped stitch and began again. Knit, purl, purl.
I said, I heard you, and it isn't that I don't want to tell you, but it's so difficult to remember. I don't dwell on these things the way you seem to. They go out of my head like a dream. I'm sure that's the normal attitude.
It may be normal, darling, but I'd rather be natural.
Holly paused in the process of reddening the rest of the cat's whiskers.
Listen, if you can't remember, try leaving the lights on.
Please understand me, Holly. I'm a very, very, very conventional person.
Oh, balls, what's wrong with a decent look at a guy you like? Men are beautiful. A lot of them are. Jose is. And if you don't even want to look at him, well, I'd say he's getting a pretty cold plate of macaroni.
Lower your voice.
You can't possibly be in love with him. Now, does that answer your question?
No, because I'm not a cold plate of macaroni. I'm a warm-hearted person. It's the basis of my character.
Okay. You've got a warm heart. But if I were a man on my way to bed, I'd rather take along a hot water bottle. It's more tangible.
You won't hear any squawks out of Jose,
she said complacently, her needles flashing in the sunlight.
What's more, I am in love with him. Do you realize I've knitted 10 pairs of Argyles in less than 3 months? And this is the second sweater.
She stretched the sweater and tossed it aside.
What's the point, though? Sweaters in Brazil, I ought to be making sun helmets.
Holly lay back and yawned.
It must be winter sometime.
It rains, that I know. Heat, rain, jungles.
Heat, jungles. Actually, I'd like that.
Better you than me.
Yes, said Holly with a sleepiness that was not sleepy. Better me than you.
On Monday, when I went down for the morning mail, the card on Holly's box had been altered, a name added. Miss Golightly and Miss Wildwood were now traveling together. This might have held my interest longer except for a letter in my own mailbox. It was from a small university review to whom I'd sent a story. They liked it, and though I must understand they could not afford to pay, they intended to publish.
Publish. That meant print.
Dizzy with excitement is no mere phrase. I had to tell someone, and taking the stairs two at a time, I pounded on Holly's door. I didn't trust my voice to tell the news. As soon as she came to the door, her eyes squinty with sleep, I thrust the letter at her. It seemed as though she'd had time to read 60 pages before she handed it back.
I wouldn't let them do it, not if they don't pay you, she said, yawning.
Perhaps my face explained she'd misconstrued, that I'd not wanted advice but congratulations. Her mouth shifted from a yawn into a smile.
Oh, I see. It's wonderful. Well, come in,
she said.
We'll make a pot of coffee and celebrate. No, I'll get dressed and take you to lunch.
Her bedroom was consistent with her parlor. It perpetuated the same camping-out atmosphere, crates and suitcases, everything packed and ready to go, like the belongings of a criminal who feels the law not far behind. In the parlor there was no conventional furniture, but the bedroom had the bed itself, a double one at that, and quite flashy, blonde wood, tufted satin. She left the door of the bathroom open and conversed from there. Between the flushing and the brushing, most of what she said was unintelligible. But the gist of it was, she supposed I knew Mag Wildwood had moved in, and wasn't that convenient? Because if you're going to have a roommate, and she isn't a dyke, then the next best thing is a perfect fool, which Mag was, because then you can dump the lease on them and send them out for the laundry. One could see that Holly had a laundry problem. The room was strewn, like a girl's gymnasium.
And you know, she's quite a successful model. Isn't that fantastic?
But a good thing, she said, hobbling out of the bathroom as she adjusted a garter.
It ought to keep her out of my hair most of the day, and there shouldn't be too much trouble on the man front. She's engaged. Nice guy, too. Though there's a tiny difference in height. I'd say a foot, her favor. What the hell?
She was on her knees, poking under the bed. After she'd found what she was looking for, a pair of lizard shoes, she had to search for a blouse, a belt. And it was a subject to ponder, how, from such wreckage, she evolved the eventual effect. Pampered, calmly immaculate, as though she'd been attended by Cleopatra's maids. She said,
"Listen,"
and cupped her hand under my chin.
"I'm glad about the story. Really, I am."
That Monday in October 1943. A beautiful day with the buoyancy of a bird. To start, we had Manhattans at Joe Bell's, and when he heard of my good luck, champagne cocktails on the house. Later, we wandered toward Fifth Avenue, where there was a parade. The flags in the wind, the thump of military bands and military feet, seemed to have nothing to do with war, but to be rather a fanfare arranged in my personal honor. We ate lunch at the cafeteria in the park. Afterwards, avoiding the zoo, Holly said she couldn't bear to see anything in a cage. We giggled, ran, sang along the paths toward the old wooden boathouse, now gone. Leaves floated on the lake. On the shore, a park man was fanning a bonfire of them, and the smoke, rising like Indian signals, was the only smudge on the quivering air. Aprils have never meant much to me. Autumns seemed that season of beginning. Spring. Which is how I felt sitting with Holly on the railings of the boathouse porch. I thought of the future and spoke of the past, because Holly wanted to know about my childhood. She talked of her own, too. But it was elusive, nameless, placeless, an impressionistic recital. Though the impression received was contrary to what one expected, for she gave an almost voluptuous account of swimming and summer, Christmas trees, pretty cousins and parties, in short, happy in a way that she was not, and never, certainly, the background of a child who had run away. Or, I asked, wasn't it true that she'd been out on her own since she was 14? She rubbed her nose.
That's true. The other isn't, but really, darling, you made such a tragedy out of your childhood I didn't feel I should compete.
She hopped off the railing.
Anyway, it reminds me, I ought to send Fred some peanut butter.
The rest of the afternoon we were east and west, worming out of reluctant grocers' cans of peanut butter, a wartime scarcity. Dark came before we'd rounded up a half-dozen jars, the last at a delicatessen on Third Avenue. It was near the antique shop with the palace of a birdcage in its window, so I took her there to see it, and she enjoyed the point, its fantasy.
But still, it's a cage.
Passing a Woolworth's, she gripped my arm.
Let's steal something,
she said, pulling me into the store where at once there seemed a pressure of eyes as though we were already under suspicion.
Come on, don't be chicken.
She scouted a counter piled with paper pumpkins and Halloween masks. The sales lady was occupied with a group of nuns who were trying on masks. Holly picked up a mask and slipped it over her face. She chose another and put it on mine. Then she took my hand, and we walked away. It was as simple as that. Outside, we ran a few blocks, I think to make it more dramatic, but also because, as I'd discovered, successful theft exhilarates. I wondered if she'd often stolen.
I used to, she said. I mean, I had to, if I wanted anything. But I still do it every now and then, sort of to keep my hand in.
We wore the masks all the way home. I have a memory of spending many hither and yawning days with Holly, and it's true, we did at odd moments see a great deal of each other. But on the whole, the memory is false. Because toward the end of the month I found a job. What is there to add? The less the better, except to say it was necessary and lasted from 9 to 5, which made our hours, Holly's and mine, extremely different. Unless it was Thursday, her sing-sing day, or unless she'd gone horseback riding in the park, as she did occasionally, Holly was hardly up when I came home. Sometimes, stopping there, I shared her wake-up coffee while she dressed for the evening. She was forever on her way out, not always with Rusty Trawler, but usually. And usually, too, they were joined by Mag Wildwood and the handsome Brazilian, whose name was Jose Ibarra Jaeger. His mother was German. As a quartet, they struck an unmusical note, primarily the fault of Ibarra Jaeger, who seemed as out of place in their company as a violin in a jazz band. He was intelligent, he was presentable, he appeared to have a serious link with his work, which was obscurely governmental, vaguely important, and took him to Washington several days a week. How then could he survive night after night in La Rue, El Morocco, listening to the Wildwood chit-chatter and staring into Rusty's raw baby buttocks face? Perhaps, like most of us in a foreign country, he was incapable of placing people, selecting a frame for their picture, as he would at home. Therefore, all Americans had to be judged in a pretty equal light, and on this basis his companions appeared to be tolerable examples of local color and national character. That would explain much. Holly's determination explains the rest. Late one afternoon, while waiting for a Fifth Avenue bus, I noticed a taxi stop across the street to let out a girl who ran up the steps of the 42nd Street Public Library. She was through the doors before I recognized her, which was pardonable, for Holly and libraries were not an easy association to make. I let curiosity guide me between the lines, debating on the way whether I should admit following her or pretend coincidence. In the end, I did neither, but concealed myself some tables away from her in the general reading room, where she sat behind her dark glasses at a fortress of literature she'd gathered at the desk. She sped from one book to the next, intermittently lingering on a page, always with a frown, as if it were printed upside down. She had a pencil poised above paper. Nothing seemed to catch her fancy. Still now and then, as though for the hell of it, she made laborious scribblings. Watching her, I remembered a girl I'd known in school, a grind, Mildred Grossman. Mildred, with her moist hair and greasy spectacles, her stained fingers that dissected frogs and carried coffee to picket lines, her flat eyes that only turned toward the stars to estimate their chemical tonnage. Earth and air could not be more opposite than Mildred and Holly, yet in my head they acquired a Siamese twinship, and the thread of thought that had sewn them together ran like this. The average personality reshapes frequently. Every few years, even our bodies undergo a complete overhaul. Desirable or not, it is a natural thing that we should change. All right. Here were two people who never would. That is what Mildred Grossman had in common with Holly Golightly. They would never change because they'd been given their character too soon, which, like sudden riches, leads to a lack of proportion. The one had splurged herself into a top-heavy realist, the other a lopsided romantic. I imagined them in a restaurant of the future, Mildred still studying the menu for its nutritional values, Holly still gluttonous for everything on it. It would never be different. They would walk through life and out of it with the same determined step that took small notice of those cliffs at the left. Such profound observations made me forget where I was. I came to, startled to find myself in the gloom of the library, and surprised all over again to see Holly there. It was after 7. She was freshening her lipstick and perking up her appearance from what she deemed correct for a library to what, by adding a bit of scarf, some earrings, she considered suitable for the colony. When she'd left, I wandered over to the table where her books remained. They were what I had wanted to see. South by Thunderbird, Byways of Brazil, The Political Mind of Latin America, and so forth. On Christmas Eve, she and Mag gave a party. Holly asked me to come early and help trim the tree. I'm still not sure how they maneuvered that tree into the apartment. The top branches were crushed against the ceiling. The lower ones spread wall to wall. Altogether, it was not unlike the Yuletide giant we see in Rockefeller Plaza. Moreover, it would have taken a Rockefeller to decorate it, for it soaked up baubles and tinsel like melting snow. Holly suggested she run out to Woolworth's and steal some balloons. She did, and they turned the tree into a fairly good show. We made a toast to our work, and Holly said,
"Look in the bedroom. There's a present for you."
I had one for her, too, a small package in my pocket that felt even smaller when I saw, square on the bed and wrapped with a red ribbon, the beautiful birdcage. "But, Holly, it's dreadful."
"I couldn't agree more, but I thought you wanted it."
"The money, $350. She shrugged.
"A few extra trips to the powder room. Promise me, though. Promise you'll never put a living thing in it."
I started to kiss her, but she held out her hand. "Gimme," she said, tapping the bulge in my pocket. I'm afraid it isn't much. And it wasn't. A St. Christopher's medal. But at least it came from Tiffany's. Holly was not a girl who could keep anything, and surely by now she has lost that medal, left it in a suitcase or some hotel drawer. But the birdcage is still mine. I've lugged it to New Orleans, Nantucket, all over Europe, Morocco, the West Indies. Yet I seldom remember that it was Holly who gave it to me, because at one point I chose to forget. We had a big falling out, and among the objects rotating in the eye of our hurricane were the birdcage and O.J. Berman and my story, a copy of which I'd given Holly when it appeared in the University Review. Sometime in February, Holly had gone on a winter trip with Rusty, Mag, and Jose Ibarra-Yeager. Our altercation happened soon after she returned. She was brown as iodine. Her hair was sun-bleached to a ghost color. She'd had a wonderful time.
"Well, first of all, we were in Key West, and Rusty got mad at some sailors or vice versa. Anyway, he'll have to wear a spine brace the rest of his life. Dearest Mag ended up in the hospital, too. First-degree sunburn. Disgusting. All blisters and citronella. We couldn't stand the smell of her, so Jose and I left them in the hospital and went to Havana. He says wait till I see Rio, but as far as I'm concerned, Havana can take my money right now. We had an irresistible guide, most of him Negro and the rest of him Chinese, and while I don't go much for one or the other, the combination was fairly riveting. So I let him play kneesy under the table because, frankly, I didn't find him at all banal. But then one night he took us to a blue movie, and what do you suppose? There he was, on the screen. Of course, when we got back to Key West, Mag was positive I'd spent the whole time sleeping with Jose. So was Rusty. But he doesn't care about that, he simply wants to hear the details. Actually, things were pretty tense until I had a heart-to-heart with Mag.
We were in the front room, where, though it was now nearly March, the enormous Christmas tree turned brown and scentless, its balloons shriveled as an old cow's dugs still occupied most of the space. A recognizable piece of furniture had been added to the room, an army cot, and Holly, trying to preserve her tropic look, was sprawled on it under a sun lamp. "And you convinced her?"
"That I hadn't slept with Jose? God, yes. I simply told, but you know, made it sound like an agonized confession. Simply told her I was a dyke."
"She couldn't have believed that."
"The hell she didn't. Why do you think she went out and bought this army cot? Leave it to me. I'm always top banana in the shock department. Be a darling, darling. Rub some oil on my back."
While I was performing this service, she said,
"O.J. Berman's in town. And listen, I gave him your story in the magazine. He was quite impressed. He thinks maybe you're worth helping. But he says you're on the wrong track. Negroes and children, who cares?"
"Not Mr. Berman, I gather."
"Well, I agree with him. I read that story twice. Brats and niggers, trembling leaves. Description. It doesn't mean anything."
My hand, smoothing oil on her skin, seemed to have a temper of its own. It yearned to raise itself and come down on her buttocks. "Give me an example," I said quietly, "of something that means something, in your opinion."
"Wuthering Heights," she said,
without hesitation. The urge in my hand was growing beyond control. "But that's unreasonable. You're talking about a work of genius."
"It was, wasn't it? My wild, sweet Kathy. God, I cried buckets. I saw it 10 times.
I said, "Oh," with recognizable relief. "Oh," with a shameful, rising inflection. "The movie." Her muscles hardened. The touch of her was like stone warmed by the sun.
"Everybody has to feel superior to somebody," she said.
but it's customary to present a little proof before you take the privilege. I don't compare myself to you or Berman. Therefore, I can't feel superior. We want different things.
Don't you want to make money?
I haven't planned that far.
That's how your stories sound, as though you'd written them without knowing the end. Well, I'll tell you, you'd better make money. You have an expensive imagination. Not many people are going to buy you bird cages.
Sorry.
You will be if you hit me. You wanted to a minute ago. I could feel it in your hand, and you want to now.
I did, terribly. My hand, my heart was shaking as I recapped the bottle of oil. Oh, no, I wouldn't regret that. I'm only sorry you wasted your money on me. Rusty Trawler is too hard a way of earning it. She sat up on the army cot, her face, her naked breasts, coldly blue in the sun lamp light.
It should take you about 4 seconds to walk from here to the door. I'll give you 2.
I went straight upstairs, got the birdcage, took it down, and left it in front of her door. That settled that. Or so I imagined, until the next morning when, as I was leaving for work, I saw the cage perched on a sidewalk ash can waiting for the garbage collector. Rather sheepishly, I rescued it and carried it back to my room, a capitulation that did not lessen my resolve to put Holly Golightly absolutely out of my life. She was, I decided, a crude exhibitionist, a time waster, an utter fake, someone never to be spoken to again. And I didn't, not for a long while. We passed each other on the stairs with lowered eyes. If she walked into Joe Bell's, I walked out. At one point, Madame Sophia Spinella, the coloratura and roller skating enthusiast who lived on the first floor, circulated a petition among the brownstone's other tenants, asking them to join her in having Miss Golightly evicted. She was, said Madame Spinella, morally objectionable, and the perpetrator of all-night gatherings that endangered the safety and sanctity of her neighbors. Though I refused to sign, secretly I felt Madame Spinella had cause to complain. But her petition failed, and as April approached May, the open-windowed warm spring nights were lurid with the party sounds, the loud-playing phonograph and martini laughter that emanated from apartment 2. It was no novelty to encounter suspicious specimens among Holly's callers, quite the contrary. But one day late that spring, while passing through the brownstone's vestibule, I noticed a very provocative man examining her mailbox. A person in his early 50s with a hard, weathered face, gray, forlorn eyes. He wore an old sweat-stained gray hat, and his cheap summer suit, a pale blue, hung too loosely on his lanky frame. His shoes were brown and brand new. He seemed to have no intention of ringing Holly's bell. Slowly, as though he were reading Braille, he kept rubbing a finger across the embossed lettering of her name. That evening, on my way to supper, I saw the man again. He was standing across the street, leaning against a tree and staring up at Holly's windows. Sinister speculations rushed through my head. Was he a detective? Or some underworld agent connected with her Sing Sing friend Sally Tomato? The situation revived my tenderer feelings for Holly. It was only fair to interrupt our feud long enough to warn her that she was being watched. As I walked to the corner, heading east toward the Hamburg Heaven at 79th and Madison, I could feel the man's attention focused on me. Presently, without turning my head, I knew that he was following me, because I could hear him whistling. Not any ordinary tune, but the plaintive prairie melody Holly sometimes played on her guitar. Don't wanna sleep, don't wanna die, just wanna go a-travelin' through the pastures of the sky. The whistling continued across Park Avenue and up Madison. Once, while waiting for a traffic light to change, I watched him out of the corner of my eye as he stooped to pet a sleazy Pomeranian. That's a fine animal you got there, he told the owner in a hoarse, countrified drawl. Hamburg Heaven was empty. Nevertheless, he took a seat right beside me at the long counter. He smelled of tobacco and sweat. He ordered a cup of coffee, but when it came, he didn't touch it. Instead, he chewed on a toothpick and studied me in the wall mirror facing us. Excuse me, I said, speaking to him via the mirror, but what do you want? The question didn't embarrass him. He seemed relieved to have it asked. "Son," he said, "I need a friend." He brought out a wallet. It was as worn as his leathery hands, almost falling to pieces. And so was the brittle, cracked, blurred snapshot he handed me. There were 7 people in the picture, all grouped together on the sagging porch of a stark wooden house, and all children, except for the man himself, who had his arm around the waist of a plump, blonde little girl, with a hand shading her eyes against the sun. "That's me," he said, pointing at himself. "That's her," he tapped the plump girl. "And this one over here," he added, indicating a tow-headed beanpole. "That's her brother, Fred." I looked at her again, and yes, now I can see it, an embryonic resemblance to Holly and the squinting, fat-cheeked child. At the same moment, I realized who the man must be. "You're Holly's father?" He blinked. He frowned. "Her name's not Holly. She was a Lula Mae Barnes. Was," he said, shifting the toothpick in his mouth. "Till she married me. I'm her husband. Doc Golightly. I'm a horse doctor, animal man. Do some farming, too, near Tulip, Texas." "Son, why are you laughing?" It wasn't real laughter. It was nerves. I took a swallow of water and choked. He pounded me on the back. "This here's no humorous matter, son. I'm a tired man. I've been 5 years looking for my woman. Soon as I got that letter from Fred saying where she was, I bought myself a ticket on the Greyhound. Lula Mae belongs home with her husband and her churin." "Children?" "Them's her churin," he said, almost shouted. He meant the 4 other young faces in the picture, 2 barefooted girls and a pair of overalled boys. Well, of course, the man was deranged. "But Holly can't be the mother of those children. They're older than she is, bigger." "Now, son," he said in a reasoning voice, "I didn't claim they was her natural-born children. Their own precious mother, precious woman, Jesus rest her soul, she passed away July 4th, Independence Day, 1936. The year of the drought. When I married Lula Mae, that was in December 1938. She was going on 14. Maybe an ordinary person, being only 14, wouldn't know their right mind. But you take Lula Mae, she was an exceptional woman. She knew good and well what she was doing when she promised to be my wife and the mother of my children. She plain broke our hearts when she ran off like she done." He sipped his cold coffee and glanced at me with a searching earnestness. "Now, son, do you doubt me? Do you believe what I'm saying is so?" I did. It was too implausible not to be fact. Moreover, it dovetailed with O.J. Berman's description of the Holly he'd first encountered in California.
"You don't know whether she's a hillbilly or an Okie or what?"
Berman couldn't be blamed for not guessing that she was a child wife from Tulip, Texas.
"Plain broke our hearts when she ran off like she done," the horse doctor repeated. "She had no cause. All the housework was done by her daughters. Lula Mae could just take it easy, fuss in front of mirrors and wash her hair. Our own cows, our own garden, chickens, pigs. Son, that woman got positively fat, while her brother growed into a giant, which is a sight different from how they come to us. 'Twas Nellie, my oldest girl, 'twas Nellie brought him into the house. She come to me one morning and said, 'Papa, I got 2 wild youngins locked in the kitchen. I caught 'em outside stealing milk and turkey eggs.' That was Lula Mae and Fred. Well, you never saw a more pitiful something. Ribs sticking out everywhere, legs so puny they can't hardly stand, teeth wobbling so bad they can't chew mush. Story was, their mother died of the TB, and their papa done the same. And all the churin, a whole raft of 'em, they've been sent off to live with different mean people. Now Lula Mae and her brother, them 2 been living with some mean, no-count people 100 miles east of Tulip. She had good cause to run off from that house, but she didn't have none to leave mine. 'Twas her home.
He leaned his elbows on the counter and, pressing his closed eyes with his fingertips, sighed.
She plumped out to be a real pretty woman. Lively, too. Talky as a jaybird. With something smart to say on every subject. Better than the radio. First thing you know, I'm out picking flowers. I tamed her a crow and taught it to say her name. I showed her how to play the guitar. Just to look at her made the tears spring to my eyes. The night I proposed, I cried like a baby, and she said, "What you want to cry for, Doc? Course we'll be married. I've never been married before." Well, I had to laugh, hug, and squeeze her. Never been married before. He chuckled, chewed on his toothpick a moment. "Don't tell me that woman wasn't happy," he said challengingly. "We all doted on her. She didn't have to lift a finger except to eat a piece of pie, except to comb her hair and send away for all the magazines. We must have had $100 worth of magazines coming to that house. Ask me, that's what done it. Looking at show-off pictures, reading dreams. That's what started her walking down the road. Every day she'd walk a little further. 1 mile and come home. 2 miles and come home. One day she just kept on." He put his hands over his eyes again. His breathing made a ragged noise. "The crow I give her went wild and flew away. All summer you could hear him, in the yard, in the garden, in the woods. All summer that damn bird was calling, 'Lula May, Lula May.'" He stayed hunched over and silent, as though listening to the long-ago summer sound. I carried our checks to the cashier. While I was paying, he joined me. We left together and walked over to Park Avenue. It was a cool, blowy evening. Swanky awnings flapped in the breeze. The quietness between us continued until I said, "But what about her brother? He didn't leave?" "No, sir," he said, clearing his throat. "Fred was with us right till they took him in the army. A fine boy, fine with horses. He didn't know what got into Lula May, how come she left her brother and husband and children. After he was in the army, though, Fred started hearing from her. The other day he wrote me her address, so I come to get her. I know he's sorry for what she done. I know she wants to go home."
He seemed to be asking me to agree with him. I told him that I thought he'd find Holly, or Lula May, somewhat changed.
"Listen, son," he said as we reached the steps of the brownstone. "I advised you I need a friend, because I don't want to surprise her and scare her none. That's why I've held off. Be my friend. Let her know I'm here."
The notion of introducing Mrs. Golightly to her husband had its satisfying aspects, and glancing up at her lighted windows, I hoped her friends were there, for the prospect of watching the Texan shake hands with Mag and Rusty and Jose was more satisfying still. But Doc Golightly's proud, earnest eyes and sweat-stained hat made me ashamed of such anticipations. He followed me into the house and prepared to wait at the bottom of the stairs.
"Do I look nice?"
he whispered, brushing his sleeves, tightening the knot of his tie. Holly was alone. She answered the door at once. In fact, she was on her way out. White satin dancing pumps and quantities of perfume announced gala intentions.
"Well, idiot," she said and playfully slapped me with her purse. "I'm in too much of a hurry to make up now. We'll smoke the pipe tomorrow, okay?"
"Sure, Lula May, if you're still around tomorrow." She took off her dark glasses and squinted at me. It was as though her eyes were shattered prisms, the dots of blue and gray and green like broken bits of sparkle.
"He told you that?"
she said in a small, shivering voice.
"Oh, please, where is he?"
She ran past me into the hall.
"Fred?"
she called down the stairs.
"Fred, where are you, darling?"
I could hear Doc Golightly's footsteps climbing the stairs. His head appeared above the banisters, and Holly backed away from him, not as though she were frightened, but as though she were retreating into a shell of disappointment. Then he was standing in front of her, hangdog and shy.
"Gosh, Lula May,"
he began, and hesitated, for Holly was gazing at him vacantly, as though she couldn't place him.
"Gee, honey," he said, "don't they feed you up here? You're so skinny.
like when I first saw you, all wild around the eye.
Holly touched his face. Her fingers tested the reality of his chin, his beard stubble.
Hello, Doc,
she said gently, and kissed him on the cheek.
Hello, Doc,
she repeated happily, as he lifted her off her feet in a rib-crushing grip. Whoops of relieved laughter shook him.
Gosh, Lula May, kingdom come.
Neither of them noticed me when I squeezed past them and went up to my room, nor did they seem aware of Madame Safia Spinella, who opened her door and yelled,
Shut up! It's a disgrace! Do your whoring elsewhere!
Divorce him? Of course I never divorced him. I was only 14, for God's sake. It couldn't have been legal.
Holly tapped an empty martini glass.
Two more, my darling Mr. Bell.
Joe Bell, in whose bar we were sitting, accepted the order reluctantly.
You're rocking the boat kinda early, he complained, crunching on a Tums.
It was not yet noon, according to the black mahogany clock behind the bar, and he'd already served us three rounds.
But it's Sunday, Mr. Bell. Clocks are slow on Sunday. Besides, I haven't been to bed yet,
she told him, and confided to me.
Not to sleep.
She blushed and glanced away guiltily. For the first time since I'd known her, she seemed to feel a need to justify herself.
Well, I had to. Doc really loves me, you know, and I love him. He may have looked old and tacky to you, but you don't know the sweetness of him, the confidence he can give to birds and brats and fragile things like that. Anyone who ever gave you confidence, you owe them a lot. I've always remembered Doc in my prayers. Please stop smirking, she demanded, stabbing out a cigarette. I do say my prayers.
I'm not smirking, I'm smiling. You're the most amazing person.
I suppose I am, she said,
and her face, wan, rather bruised-looking in the morning light, brightened. She smoothed her tousled hair, and the colors of it glimmered like a shampoo advertisement.
I must look fierce. But who wouldn't? We spent the rest of the night roaming around in a bus station. Right up to the last minute, Doc thought I was going to go with him, even though I kept telling him, But Doc, I'm not 14 anymore, and I'm not Lula May. But the terrible part is, and I realized it while we were standing there, I am. I'm still stealing turkey eggs and running through a briar patch. Only now I call it having the mean reds.
Joe Bell disdainfully settled the fresh martinis in front of us.
Never love a wild thing, Mr. Bell, Holly advised him. That was Doc's mistake. He was always lugging home wild things. A hawk with a hurt wing. One time it was a full-grown bobcat with a broken leg. But you can't give your heart to a wild thing. The more you do, the stronger they get. Until they're strong enough to run into the woods or fly into a tree, then a taller tree, then the sky. That's how you'll end up, Mr. Bell, if you let yourself love a wild thing. You'll end up looking at the sky.
She's drunk, Joe Bell informed me.
Moderately, Holly confessed. But Doc knew what I meant. I explained it to him very carefully, and it was something he could understand. We shook hands and held on to each other, and he wished me luck.
She glanced at the clock.
He must be in the Blue Mountains by now.
What's she talking about?
Joe Bell asked me. Holly lifted her martini.
Let's wish the Doc luck, too,
she said, touching her glass against mine.
Good luck, and believe me, dearest Doc, it's better to look at the sky than live there. Such an empty place. So vague. Just a country where the thunder goes and things disappear.
Trawler marries fourth. I was on a subway somewhere in Brooklyn when I saw that headline. The paper that bannered it belonged to another passenger. The only part of the text that I could read, Rutherford Rusty Trawler, the millionaire playboy often accused of pro-Nazi sympathies, eloped to Greenwich yesterday with a beautiful... Not that I wanted to read any more. Holly had married him. Well, well. I wished I were under the wheels of the train, but I'd been wishing that before I spotted the headline.
for a head full of reasons. I hadn't seen Holly, not really, since our drunken Sunday at Joe Bell's bar. The intervening weeks had given me my own case of the mean reds. First off, I'd been fired from my job, deservedly, and for an amusing misdemeanor too complicated to recount here. Also, my draft board was displaying an uncomfortable interest, and having so recently escaped the regimentation of a small town, the idea of entering another form of disciplined life made me desperate. Between the uncertainty of my draft status and a lack of specific experience, I couldn't seem to find another job. That was what I was doing on a subway in Brooklyn, returning from a discouraging interview with an editor of the now defunct paper, PM. All this, combined with the city heat of the summer, had reduced me to a state of nervous inertia, so I more than half meant it when I wished I were under the wheels of the train. The headline made the desire quite positive. If Holly could marry that absurd fetus, then the army of wrongness rampant in the world might as well march over me. Or, and the question is apparent, was my outrage a little the result of being in love with Holly myself? A little, for I was in love with her, just as I'd once been in love with my mother's elderly colored cook, and a postman who let me follow him on his rounds, and a whole family named McKendrick. That category of love generates jealousy, too. When I reached my station, I bought a paper, and reading the tail end of that sentence, discovered that Rusty's bride was a beautiful cover girl from the Arkansas hills, Miss Margaret Thatcher Fitzhugh Wildwood. Mag! My legs went so limp with relief I took a taxi the rest of the way home. Madame Safia Spinella met me in the